Okay, so now we find you in Israel. You're married. Did you serve in the army?
I served in the army, but I'll get to that later because I served in the army after I came back from Madison.
Oh.
So it was not between 68 and 75. Okay. It was after 83.
Okay. So we'll move on now to when and how you met George Mosse. And were you affiliated with the Hebrew University in those years at all? So it wasn't through the university that you met George.
No.
Okay.
So as I said, at this stage, I was being the Goebbels of Israel and operating in various institutions, teaching at student kind of organizations, youth group leaders, and so on, making a reasonable living, but not part of the university. In fact, the thought of becoming an academic or a researcher was the last thing on my mind. I always read. I was always interested. But I had not found anyone who influenced me or who I admired or who could be a model at all. Then I think it was in 1968 at a friend's house, Ze'ev Mankiewicz, who was a close friend of mine and was not at all well, was appointed as George's assistant when George came to Jerusalem to teach in 1968. So one Friday night, he invited me and he said, "We've got this overseas professor, he's a nice guy, come and meet him." So, obviously I went, and at that stage they all, the student revolutions were on, and we said to him, "But Professor Mosse, how do you deal with this? The campus is on fire, it's kind of mad, what's going on there?" And he said, "Oh no, I teach at 10 in the morning. No student revolution begins before 2 in the afternoon." So when he said that, I said, okay, this is a guy for me. This is somebody that I can appreciate, that he was funny, he was warm, he was hilarious, he was kind of non-pretentious. And so I decided, I think he told me what courses he was giving. So I said, "Oh, go and sit and listen to this guy and see what he has to say." So he's teaching a course on, I think it was the next day or two, a course on anti-Semitism. And he walks into the class, and there's this group of Israelis, and he starts by saying, "You all, you all look like Aryans." This is how he begins. So of course you know what he means. I mean, he knows, right? He's talking about stereotypes, and he's talking about the fact that Israelis want to become these kind of blue-eyed, blonde, muscular soldier types. So immediately I saw, hey, this is a guy that I can appreciate, that also talks at a certain level that I like. So over the years, between 1968 and 75, I saw him when he came to Israel all the time, and we invited him. Well, I wasn't married until 73, but even after that, we had him over to the house, and we became quite friendly. I'm not sure when I started calling him George. I think until then it was Professor Mosse, especially coming from a South African background. And then at one point he said to me, Stephen, when are you going to stop being a Boy Scout and becoming serious? Why don't you come and study with me in Madison? Now, the reason I would never have thought of doing a PhD in Jerusalem is because at that stage you had to do it in Hebrew. To this day, I can lecture in Hebrew. I can't write in Hebrew. It's unthinkable. I had no idea what medicine was, where medicine was, and nor did George explain to me that by going to Madison in the mid-70s, you are going to sub-Siberian weather. And I'm from South Africa and Israel, where the sun shines.
He left that
and
out.
Where Israel, he left that out. So basically, I came to Madison for one reason only, and that was for George. Since then, as you know, and we can develop this, George became the formative influence in my life intellectually, in career terms, in friendship terms, and as I said to you, in a certain way, as my second father. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those, that's 1968 evening with the student revolutions became a very important part of my life. In fact, I've held two academic jobs, one in Portland and one in Jerusalem, both through George. Mm. He got me the job in Jerusalem, he got me the job at Reed College. So,
but yeah. That is not unusual, Steve, I think, in the sense that he did that for a lot of his students, sometimes successfully, sometimes not as successfully, but it was a different time, of course. That's harder to do now,
yes,
as we all know.
Yes.
But I'm sure that he put a lot of effort into getting you these positions. I can imagine, especially the one at the Hebrew University, because that could not have been easy.
No, absolutely.
We don't need to go into the reasons.
Yeah. Did he ever speak to you about it?
A bit.
What did he say? You know more than me.
Well, he said it was tough, you know, and because, of course, that is maybe more for par for the course in Israel than it is here, in the sense that professors often try to get their students positions at the universities. But he was not a member of the faculty in the sense that he was a permanent visiting professor or something who taught only in English. But, you know, George was well connected and he was brilliant, as you know, and he was charismatic and he had some allies. I know Arielli was supportive, and so yes, it worked.
Right, that worked. So yes, in many ways, I mean, obviously, so he's influenced my life,
yes,
basically, and of course, when I was here, the cultural history course that he gave,
mm-hmm,
was stunning. Although I must say, Hannah, my wife, came to listen. And sometimes I had the feeling that he was talking just to Hannah and me, because there were times that we were rolling on the floor with hilarity of what he was saying. And a lot of these people from Wisconsin, I'm not sure if they had the slightest idea what he was saying, especially when he talked about Wisconsin farm kids, or as the peasants. And they couldn't have been thrilled. But for us, there was, I mean, to Hannah still, it's worth it, you know, she learned about art, which is her field, through George.
It's extraordinary.
So George, in many ways, you hear when I talk, and I speak about George, I speak as George.
Mm-hmm.
I have his accent.
Yes.
We've internalized George. So I spoke about a model.
Yes.
George became a model for not just me. I mean, I think the three of us, the most important, at least of my generation, was Paul, Andy, and me.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't with the Seymour and mm-hmm. David Sabin.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
And there was even a generation before that, but we won't go into that.
Whom I didn't know, but, and I'm sure that the same thing applied.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, he was a model. But the teaching that I do doesn't only come from George. A huge amount does. But the other comes from teaching in Habonim, which had to be existential, which mm-hmm. had to be relevant, which had to be alive.
Because mm-hmm.
you had to motivate kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the kind of combination of Habonim and then George mm-hmm. that kind of influenced the way in which I teach. And in that sense, both of those influences are at work. But I don't know how to exaggerate George's role in my life. And you said something very moving in your description when you say here, it's later, I'm skipping now. So you and your wife Hannah and your children, your home became the place in Israel that George felt most at home. In many ways, the center of his intellectual and emotional life there. That's a wonderful thing to say.
Well, it's true.
I do know that George was as neurotic as I am, and so if he would be invited for 7 o'clock,
I can attest to that.
At 7 o'clock, at 6:30, we would look down, and there was George pacing around, waiting to come up. And I would say, George, you can come up now. Yes, and Gidi Shimoni, another person from Habonim, he once wrote, "We in Jerusalem measure time according to before, during, or after George's visit." Mm-hmm. So the impact he made on a huge amount of people, even if it was for a short time,
in Israel,
was great.
Yes.
Some of the academics were completely shocked and appalled by him, because I remember one of them speaking, I think it was in 1969 or 70, George was talking about masturbation in his class. You can't do that. So, and they were absolutely appalled. But of course, these were the things that attracted students, that he talked about these things. So almost everybody who came into contact with him either formed a relationship with him or was deeply influenced. And of course, the fact that we didn't know George was gay, but the fact that he was unmarried and didn't have family meant that he had time and even a need to be with his students, with whom they had developed friendships.
There wasn't that distance.
Not at all. Yeah.
That German milieu at the Hebrew University would have kept with is somewhat present, I would assume.
Yeah, but I think it's true here too, by the way. When I was in Madison, there were no other professors who sat outside of the Union by the lake and had this big circle of people, and George would hold court with him. I don't remember that being true in Madison either.
Interesting.
And so obviously he wasn't from Jerusalem, so these were the friendships he formed. And so that distance, as you say, didn't apply, which made it even more attractive. And then, of course, he befriended my whole family. My wife, who's an Israeli, although she was born in Germany, she came when she was 1.5. And when we came to Madison, he'd always spoken English to her. But when we were coming to Madison, he said to me, "Oh, Steve, how is Hannah going to manage? She only speaks German." And I said, "George, she doesn't know a word of German. She always speaks English."
Do you mean he was speaking German to her all these years?
No, I don't know. That was George. And then he came, and we became close in a way that I never quite understood. We never discussed our relationship. There wasn't a need to.
No, you knew.
Yeah, yes. And I liked that. And what are we going to say? I'll tell you about his towards his death. But when we were in Madison, and we had Dioni, our boy, was born in Madison. Two stories that at Eagle Heights, where we lived, George would often come. And we had is it recording?
Yes.
We had a little, do you call it pram? Pram.
Mm-hmm.
And Yoni was in there, and George would say, "Oh, I really want to get in the pram and have Steve wheel me." Who else would say a thing? That was lovely. And then my son had his Brit Milah, his circumcision. And we said to George, "You're going to be his godfather." And George came along, and we have to hand Yoni to him. Or says, no, no, I can't hold him, I'll drop him. So George never really held Yoni at the Brit.
So and over that time, we were very close, but still he was my PhD advisor.
Indeed, yeah.
And there were certain things that he said at the beginning. I said, I don't really know German. He said, well, it's a technical thing, go and learn it. And so he was tough in certain things. Mm-hmm. It just deepened and deepened without us ever talking about it. So let me just say two things. I'll skip to his death. As you know, I came here a week before he died, or two mm-hmm. weeks. I think it was a week, actually.
It was more like a matter of days.
Matter of days.
Amazing.
And we spent the whole weekend talking about everything in the world, but not about his illness.
Right.
Not about our relationship, just talking wonderfully. He just said two things about his being ill. He said, oh, I thought I could go on forever. That was the only thing. Then he said the most moving thing he's ever said to me, which was, I said, George, we've been talking a long time, you must be exhausted. And he said, Stephen, I can never ever be tired talking to you.
Oh,
so that moved me deeply.
Yes, yes.
And then he went. Mm-hmm. So, and then there's the famous story which you've got to tell about his getting the honorary doctorate.
Yes.
Which that's your story, that's not my story. So it did deepen considerably, and we all loved him for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a kind of a presence.
Well, and he knew that he was loved. I think that's the important thing. Yeah. He understood that. I think it was a great need for him, that kind of nourishment and interaction in a way that, as you said, is unique and is, for me, such an essential part of education. To have that bond of affection and concern, I think that's, and obviously given the success of his students, it makes a difference. You know,
it makes
a huge difference to have that personal connection. So essentially, your graduate work was all done at UW.
I did the MA at London.
Okay.
No, it was a 1-year thing.
Oh, that's
I got it done in 1 year.
And so you came into UW
with a master's.
Okay. And were accepted to work on your doctorate. Okay.
Right. I don't know. I didn't have to. I would have failed all of those tests that you've got to do with math and logic.
Yes.
I never had to do them. It was probably also through George, who then got me a subsidy for my. But I became a TA in the second year, towards the ILS. Mm-hmm. But for the first year, he got me a special grant from some senator at the Capitol. So I got 1 year free. Tuition, and there was some senator who gave some money or some congressman there.
That's interesting because from what Seymour Drescher has and others have told me, George often funded things and said that it came from other.
Sent me the first week to go and thank the guy.
Oh, really? Okay.
I wandered around for about 2 hours knocking on doors and he was never around, so I left a note and that was it. But he wouldn't have given me a name of somebody without, I don't remember the name.
Yes, okay.
I doubt it.
Never mind,
No, so he didn't fund it.
Okay,
And the rest of the time I had a TA ship.
TA ship, so.
Yeah, and taught at, not a TA, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a TA. I got a teaching job at the ILS where I gave courses on my own.
Yes. Wow, that's unusual for a graduate student. I mean, that is...
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not in those days, but now it would be...
Last week, this has nothing to do with the thing, last week I get a note from Christopher Hamlin, who taught with me at ILS in 1976, and we're meeting this Friday, the day after tomorrow in New York.
Really?
So those from those same days. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. That's amazing. Okay, so you're in Madison. You're beginning work on your thesis.
Well,
so
first you've got to go. Oh, let me tell the following story.
Okay.
First you've got to do prelims. Is that what it was called?
Yes,
prelims.
Right.
So it was 2 years. And I took with Harvey Goldberg. I took with Sterling Fishman. I took with George Mosser. And I took with Theodore Hammerer in German history.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the prelims, and I did extremely well in 3 out of the 4, but I failed German history. Why did I fail German history? I learned later that all of George's students who did German history with Theodore Hammerow failed in their prelims. I mean, give me a break. That was it. That was Theodore Hammerow.
Talk about passive aggressive.
So, of course, if you pass 3, you can go on.
Yes, right.
So there obviously was some deep issue between the two.
Well,
Hammerow
it
was
could
jealous.
Be,
I don't know what it was.
Well, it could be that subject of your first year thesis.
Oh, it could be.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yes, there never was. I think there were political differences, departmental differences, the whole approach, different styles of history, whatever.
Right. Although, when my book came out, the first book, The Brothers and Strangers, he had a long critical review of it in commentary. It was a good review. It was critical and good.
Well, he once wrote a critique of George's career.
Where? That's interesting.
Well, I will send it to you. It was quite laudatory, actually.
Really?
Yes. So that's what I mean by passive aggressive. He would flunk the students. He would sometimes throw these roadblocks in George's path and could be rude. On the other hand, he was also, quite laudatory if he wanted to.
That's
be.
Interesting. But that's a fact, I can tell you. And I really didn't fail that exam.
I can imagine you didn't.
So anyway.
So you're in Madison, and you've spoken a bit about your teachers here and what you did, in terms of your early coursework. So,
Let me just say about the teachers.
Yeah.
First of all, I came, remember, much older.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was really kind of a retarded guy. I started the PhD at 33.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, my age group was not that far removed from my teachers. And because I had children, I was married, even though I lived in what I think it was Hammerow called genteel poverty in Eagle Heights, in a very, very small apartment, I became friends with my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So two people, I became very close to Sterling Fishman,
mm-hmm.
who was very close to George.
Yes.
And very close to Klaus Bergholm. And for both of us, it was a very meaningful encounter because here was the first non-Jewish German that I became a friend to. And I was the first Jew with whom Klaus could really become friends. And we became friends first through violent encounters on the tennis courts, which then blossomed into a real friendship. So, although I was also quite close to many people at Eagle Heights, and still am with some of them, it was also because I was older that I became friendly not just with George, but with some of my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I was ever mentioned in print was when Stanley Payne quoted a paper I'd written, a seminar paper for him, in his book on fascism. And the paper was called The Metapolitics of Nazism, and he put it in his book.
Mm.
So these things were also meaningful.
And helpful to you.
And very helpful, very complimentary. And he reminded me of it yesterday. So yes, very positive, completely different to the English experience.
So you, in some ways, you became part of George's circle here in Madison. And actually, by the time you had arrived in Madison, George had somewhat withdrawn because he was spending more time in Israel. And, my feeling is that after the intensity of the 60s in Madison and in George's really intense engagement, both politically in Madison and as a kind of figure, both supporting the students and oppositional, and also his immersion in university committees and overseeing a huge number of doctorates within 10 years, I mean, extraordinary number, that his new engagement with Israel meant that in Madison he became less and less engaged in a way, both intellectually and in terms of other parts of his life. I mean, the first time he had gone to Israel was 1951, I believe. So in he was part of that group, Sholem, you know, he knew those Robert Belch, all those people before he met you. But so he had a long history there, but I think that this engagement in the late 60s changed his relationship here in Madison. But you had this circle, he had this circle, and you in some ways became part of his circle that he had developed
right.
over many years. That's
right.
That is, I see the difference between your experience, because you were a little older, and that of many of the other beginning students here.
Yeah, I think I was considerably older.
Okay.
I was 33 yeah. when I started, 38 when I finished. Yeah. Okay. So I was, you know, I was just the backward kid. I think George had, it was very inclusive. Also, the other people with whom we were, he always included them. I remember going to his party, he sometimes had parties.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time I met Jeff Herf. And he would say, oh, he's into engineering and the Nazis. And he would include everyone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So I'm not...
Oh, yes, he was...
I don't know if I was a particularly... I mean, he you know, he because we came from Israel, I suppose he
yes.
looked after us. But Steve Uran was also here.
Mm-hmm.
But he left.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't finish,
mm-hmm.
I think.
That's right. It was, I think, a regret of George's that he didn't finish.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so how did you choose your dissertation topic? Was this something that you came up with, or...?
My first choice was Hannah Arendt.
Oh, okay.
Which George didn't want me to do.
Really?
Not at all. And
did he give you a reason?
He said, yeah, it's not a great... He didn't really give a reason. It's not a great topic.
Because that and would then, have been quite a... Quite
wait, a wait. Then he reluctantly agreed. Okay. Then I started doing research. And two things stopped me from doing it. Somebody, I've forgotten who it was, had written the kind of thesis that I wanted to write. So it had been okay. done. He never published it. That's why I can't remember the name.
Hmm.
Okay. The second was Mary McCarthy held the Arendt papers at the Library of Congress. And I wrote to her. Would I have access? Quick as a flash came the reply, no. So that was out.
Mm. Okay.
And then I had to come up with it with another topic, and George said, oh, why don't you write about the ghetto? No, that didn't have flesh. But I thought, that sounds interesting. And then it worked out to be what it was, which is the Brothers and Strangers book,
mm-hmm.
which is about the ghetto, but about images of the ghetto. It was also very much in the Mossian kind of tradition,
mm-hmm.
But which I think I expanded. It wasn't just the negative thing, it was also the positive thing, and the relationship of Jew and non-Jews. So it worked out very nicely, and I think there was another option. Before I started the PhD, there were two things. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I was still under the influence of some of these Zionist propagandists. And I was thinking of doing my PhD in education. And I said to George, should I do it in education? He said, no, what's education? Don't be silly. Okay. Then I went to visit, on George's recommendation, Uri Tal, who was then in Philadelphia.
And Uri Tal said, do your PhD on Theodor Fritsch, who was a leading anti-Semite at this magazine called Der Hammer. And I went to George and said, should I do it on Fritsch? He said, no, 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 you must do something bigger. You must do something more significant. And that's how I got into the top. And he was dead right. Had I did it, just done it on one figure, it would have been minor. And the Brothers and Strangers had some resonance. That's the history. How you bringing things back that I haven't dreamed about for years.
So, you knew something of George's work in those years. I mean, the trajectory of his career starting out in constitutional, you know, English constitutional history, and then ending up in German Jewish history and Jewish history. In those years, he was really moving into what became the anthropological turn.
I don't understand what you mean by that.
Well, some people call it the cultural term, but essentially you could say it's influenced by a certain German-Jewish scholarship that preceded George. It is really very much a part of that tradition, influenced by Jung, but it's really aesthetics of politics, but also symbolism using these kind of underlying tropes or archetypes to explain political behavior, mass behavior, that sort of thing. And it ended up in, you know,
right,
the nationalization of the masses.
Well, it started even with the Crisis book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I didn't know. I mean, I only learned very gradually about the English history, the constitutional history, the kind of history that puts me totally to sleep. In fact, George writes somewhere about somebody who said to him, oh, George, you're such an interesting person. Why do you write such boring history? Now, I would say that's true for English constitutional history. But there's another story, too. I didn't know that he had done this theological work. So at that stage, being a naive guy, I was very much under the impression that that stage of Emil Fackenheim's Jewish theology, and I was starting to speak to him, and I was sprouting away on this, and I said to him, oh, George, you know a lot about history. You don't know anything about theology. So he didn't say anything. It's just that the next day on his desk were those books that he'd written on theology. So then I swallowed hard. So I didn't really know much about his prior work. What I knew, I don't know what year the Crisis book came out.
64.
Okay, so when I met him, I read the Crisis book.
Okay.
So for me, I mean, later I wrote about George, but that was much later, about the trajectory. It was then that I learned about his English history, the theology, the Reformation he'd written on. But for me, the George was the Crisis on. And that still is the George for me, which is not to denigrate his other. I know the Reformation book or the Culture book, one of them is with Königsberger, still sells today.
So Europe in the 16th century.
Europe in the 16th century.
That was another aspect of his work.
Right, for which I cannot speak, because that was not my George. George, for me, is everything he wrote post-crisis of German ideology. But let me make one thing clear, and I tried to make it clear in an article I wrote. People talk about the cultural turn. When they speak about the cultural turn now, they don't mean what George did. They mean the deconstructionist moment, the linguistic turn.
Yes,
George was not that at all. But he was about introducing, as you say, symbolism, the irrational,
the masses, all of these things, but it, not the cultural turn in the sense in the that people that talk about.
Yes, exactly.
And that's important, because he wasn't like that.
Although I think in some ways he influenced that. We don't have to...
I don't know. I don't know if he did.
In terms of the study of literature and in popular literature, not method so
not
much.
Not method.
But he opened up certain approaches to cultural history that... I think resonated. I mean, most of that came, of course, out of the French school and Foucault and others. But
George said, "I don't like wobbles."
Yeah, that's.
I don't like fruit that is soft.
Right.
And these guys are soft and wobbly.
Yes. Yes.
So there's this real difference.
There's a difference. Oh, indeed. Very.
He may have influenced them, but I think George did, and that's why I think it's important to stress that the Peter Gays and the Walter Lacours and the Georges are not the same kind of thing as what happened later.
Oh, indeed. Completely different. And I know George was resistant and somewhat appalled by some of the direction. I remember once he said that all evil emanates from the English departments, which I'm sure had something to do with this turn. But okay, so we have some idea of how you came to your topic, and I think you were probably one of the first students that worked on a specifically Jewish, I mean, maybe one of the first students that went specifically into Jewish history, because that was also happening at this time, that he taught his first course in 71 on Jewish, and specifically Jewish history. And he also was embracing his Jewish identity in the 60s in a way that he hadn't before then. It was a kind of transformational period for him. Part of it evidenced in his embrace of Israel, but also the Zionism that he developed, because he did always say that he was a Zionist, of course. He was a Zionist of a particular kind, but so you came at a very rich time for him intellectually, culturally, just, you know, in terms of his work. It was a very, very productive time.
Mm-hmm. What was he doing at that? He was doing, it was always, the crisis book, or the masses book, mm-hmm. or the sex book, or the death book.
Yeah.
All of these things were happening at the time.
Yeah.
But I did do Jewish history, but you must remember that when I went to the history department at the Hebrew University, which divides between Jewish history and general mm-hmm. history, I went to general history.
That's
very
right.
Glad that I did so, because if I approached Jewish history, it was from the outside
mm-hmm.
in,
exactly.
not from the in out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to this day true, and I was told that for my second book, it must not be Jewish history.
Oh, okay.
So that's when I did the book on Nietzsche reception mm-hmm. in Germany. Mm-hmm. It had to be non-Jewish. Mm-hmm. I had some Jewish things in there, but it's about 5% of the
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was important, and I've mm-hmm. always stressed. I don't want to say I'm just a Jewish historian. I'd like to say, you know, I'm in German and Jewish cultural and intellectual history,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is basically what George did.
It is very much similar to his okay, so shall we move on to your post-Madison career? Are we ready? Is there anything else you want to say?
Where are we now?
You had studied at UW, and
What was George like in the classroom?
Yes, we didn't really talk about him, and also as a dissertation advisor. We can
separate things. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I think that's a good idea.
Well, George in the classroom was George everywhere in the classroom, right?
Yes.
George, you could hear George. There's no question. There was no mumbling, and there was booming when George was there. And of course, that was part of his technique, that he would come out and it would be all powerful. And his technique, I mean, apart from being also, he was funny, he was outrageous. The difference between him and Harvey Goldberg is important, because I went to Harvey Goldberg's thing. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Goldberg, there would be lots and lots of people, and what it would be like at a political meeting where you all come out with the same opinion and ready to riot in the streets. Mm-hmm. And with George, George would provoke you and make you angry. So he'd make you think, and there was a clear difference between them, and I went for the George. I wasn't going to go out into the streets. So I didn't really learn anything from Harvey, to tell you the truth.
He was more of an entertainer, in a sense.
But so was George.
Yes,
George was always entertaining, but there was a point.
Yes.
And of course, one of his techniques, which I've never done, was repeating. You know. He always came out and did this. Always, 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 always. I mean, that's how he talked. And, of course, he had something which I couldn't have, which was a kind of natural authority. So in Jerusalem, when he was teaching, you have in Jerusalem probably the biggest percentage of Besserwissers that there are in the world. Besserwissers, people know better than you. So he's teaching a class on Weimar. And Guy stands up and says, "No, it wasn't like that. I was there." And George's answer was, as a teacher, "Oh, you're in the valley. I'm on the mountain." Now, I could never say that, but he could say that.
I bet you could.
So as a teacher, he was magnetic. He was funny. He was provocative. He was powerful.
He also demanded your attention. He didn't appreciate it if you didn't take his, didn't give him your attention or didn't take what he was doing deadly seriously. So there was this entertainment part of it, but it also was a very, very important, serious matter that he was discussing, and he didn't expect you to be there reading a paper.
But it never happened with me. I was always with him.
But I mean, in terms of the classroom, he controlled it. I recall that, and being somewhat intimidated when I first went to his classroom because of that, you know, that he was aware of the students, and he expected you to give him your full attention, that this was a serious matter. You know, I recall that very, very vividly. And he did train the classes, you know, he trained them because he would snap at them if he felt that there wasn't the level of engagement that he wanted or discipline. You know, he had that kind of German sense of discipline about this subject, you know. He really didn't know that.
I never experienced that, because I was attentive and I was interested. I didn't have to.
And I
don't even remember him doing that to the class, because the class seemed to me to be listening, although I think a hell of a lot they didn't understand.
Well, you'd be surprised. People, you know, it may take some time, but I recall being, I didn't know anything about the subject when some, you know, I've taken some courses, but it was amazing how much you could absorb from his classes at a very high level of
engagement. When did you hear him first?
I think it was 71 or 72, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were still here in Madison?
No. I came in 75.
Oh, you came, that was even before you.
You heard him before me.
Yeah.
No, I heard him in Jerusalem at that time.
Yeah. He, I recall, had a brace on his neck. He was having some terrible...
In 71?
Yes, he was kind of spinal issues, and, you know, he didn't sometimes didn't seem in the best of moods, let us say. He had some structural issues in those years that he overcame somehow.
Because in 1978...
Yeah,
he had that same brace.
Really?
But he was in... Remember, we were talking yesterday about this drug?
Yes.
It was quite clear that he couldn't really go on. And I took him home, and I helped him out.
You mean he in front of the classroom...
I walked up to him and said, "George, I think we should stop now."
Really?
Yeah.
And because he was on a medicine because of the pain?
Couldn't go on.
Yeah, I think he had some medical challenges in the course of his life that, you know, he overcame.
Mm-hmm. And Prussian will, yes. Iron will.
You know, he once said to me, he said, "Oh, my arm hurts here." And I said, "But what is that?" He said, "Well, I've had this since I was a teenager. I've always been aching and in pain, you know?" And I thought, gee, well, that's...
This is the Prussian side of it. Yeah.
I would have, you know, not survived such a level of, you know,
and it pain. Happened once, and I took him out and
home. That's amazing, yeah.
Don't you remember the year? It was 76, 77, 78, I don't remember. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
So it's about 11:30. Do you want to continue or... Okay.
Unless you don't want
to. No, I just wanted to check in with you to make sure that...
What is the right time?
It's... Well, my time is 11:30 here.
So is mine slow or is yours...
Well,
I can tell you. Hang on. Before we go on. Steve Asheim is correct. 11:26.
Okay, yes. Okay, so I'm at 11:27. Okay.
I think we're going to finish. We don't know.
Well, all right. Well, you know, we can always decide if we'd like to do a little bit more in the fall. We'll see. Okay, so.
In the fall? Oh.
When I'm visiting Israel. But
I somehow think of myself as a New Yorker then. You know, will I be in Jerusalem?
You'll be back, Steve.
That's yeah.
Okay, so what were you. You were in. Madison, you were one of actually George's final students that he accepted. There were only a couple more after him.
Little Berkowitz.
Yes, and there were some at the Hebrew University. There was Judy Donnerstein.
Donnerstein. I don't know where she
passed away at a fairly young age, I think in her early 50s or something, mid-50s. Yes, it was rather sad. And then, Ari Carmon, who is currently the head of the Israel Democracy Project, was he a...
Switch that off, and I'll tell you the story. I won't tell it off.
Okay, we're back. But yes, there were some students at the Hebrew University that got their PhDs under George's direction. I don't have the list with me, but there were some. And of course, he had a major impact there just in terms of his public persona, but also with specific undergraduates and graduate students that were studying there that he influenced through his teaching that have gone on to positions in the Israeli government and culture and really in the US, Europe, and in Israel. So there was a major impact outside the classroom, even, because I know he was often on the radio. He had that wide circle of friends there.
He had his friend Scott.
Oh, yes, I remember. Elder.
Scott Elder, who worked for the radio.
Right.
And with whom George was quite close. And with some other people. So, yes, absolutely.
Scott and Rivka, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost contact with them.
Me too.
But, and I think they're probably retired now, but...
I don't know.
Yes.
I saw him a few years ago, and the only topic we have in common is George. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so, maybe should we move on now to... Do you want to say any more about George as a dissertation advisor in terms of... He just basically usually just said, you know...
Well, once we agreed on the ghetto,
yes.
Then he said, just go. When we were together a great deal, but we never talked about the dissertation. Then I gave him chapter one. He looked at it, read it, made one or two very, very minor suggestions. Mm-hmm. And then I gave him the whole thing, and that was it. There was never much... It was clear that he liked it. He was not at my dissertation defense. He was in Israel. And for my dissertation defense was on a Sunday morning. And Stanley Payne was chairing it. And he forgot about it. So they had to wake him up or round him up specially, and he ran in short pants. And there was Sterling, Klaus, Stanley, and this man, who the only one who was critical and asked me good questions from education, not French rag.
Herbst?
Not Herbst. Herb. Herb.
Not Jürgen Herbst, not Castle, not...
Herb.
Gosh, I don't know if it would have been.
Forgotten his name, Herb somebody. Mm. He asked critical questions. Was over in an hour, and they said congratulations, and then they all took me out for a lovely dinner, and off I went to Reed College. So that as dissertation advisor, but you know, what else is he supposed to do? You do a dissertation, you've got to do it on your own.
Right.
You can't be fed.
I think some students don't understand that and rather resent it when their professors. Especially now when, you know, universities are much more service oriented, you know, that the students expect, you know, we're paying this money, so therefore we should get all of this attention. I do think that's changed somewhat, but anyways, we won't go into
that. But it's difficult. I mean, if you're doing a dissertation, you really have, you know much more than any advisor will know.
Right.
It's working.
Yes, we've just worked it. Okay, so you are now, you have your degree, you're starting your family, and you said George helped you get this position at Reed College. So, tell me about that. You
Reed College?
Yes, yeah.
I'll tell you one thing about Portland, Oregon, apart from it being beautiful.
Yes.
It's got the best bookstore in the world. Powell's Bookstore, which is one of the great things I liked about Portland. I did not enjoy Portland, Reed College. My wife loved it, painted there and loved it, didn't want to leave. For me, Reed College was, and the students were good, but it was a petty place. I remember offices were next to each other, and faculty members were very busy writing negative letters about the colleagues in the next door office. It was like Peyton Place. It was not for me. And then they learned that I was writing this book, or it had come out, Brothers and Strangers, 1982. No, it came out in 1982, so I was writing or finishing it in Reed, and the word went out, Asheim is trying to go national by writing a book. Writing a book means you are not teaching properly. So I felt, you know, well, what the hell am I doing here? It's just too small. It's too provincial. And they don't encourage you to write. So my experience there was not a great one, although I gave a lot of lectures to the Jewish community. And I had the best student I've probably ever had in my life was a farm boy from Iowa, whose name, non-Jewish, Jason Weeks, who wrote a paper on Martin Buber that blew my mind, and I thought he is bent for greater things. Never ever heard from him or of him again. So there were some light. I made some friends, but I'm very glad I didn't stay there.
Doesn't sound like a good fit. So you were there for how long?
2 years.
2 years, okay. And then how did this position in Jerusalem come about? I know we spoke a bit about George helping with that, but...
Well, George knew that I had lived in Israel. He knew that at some stage I wanted to go back. I came to Madison and told George, you know, I'm not really happy in Reed. And he said, oh, well, we'll see, maybe we can get you something. The next thing I knew, he said, we'll get you a job. I've got you a job in Jerusalem. And he'd spoken to Arieli, and at that stage, just two or three guys got together and gives you an appointment. Now, there's a real question. Because now, at the Hebrew University, there must be at least four committees that you go through. Which one is the better system, I can't tell you, because it's on one level, it's very corrupt. You know, Mosser mm-hmm. speaks to Arieli, and they say, oh, let's bring Asheim, and that's it. On the other hand, I don't think the quality of the old system is worse than the quality of the present system, because the present system has a leveling kind of effect.
It does.
So, whereas I couldn't possibly say anymore, let's bring back the old system. But it worked for many people. So basically, yes, George got me the job with the support of Arieli and maybe one or two other people, which was deeply resented. So when I came to Israel, the word was amongst colleagues, it took at least 2-3 years for me to break through the ice. I was clearly the outsider. I came together with two other people, Gubby Motzkin from outside and Robert Wistrich. And the word was, they have been parachuted in. These are alien invaders brought in by people of power who've got nothing to do with us. So it took some time for me to break through and to be accepted. I remember the day, and I become friendly with this particular guy. About 2 months after being there, I get him in the mail, a book arrives, and I open it up, and there is Brothers and Strangers, which I've never seen. It's my first book, deeply exciting, wonderful. So he's in my office, I show it to him. He says, that's nice, and he walks out. It was so deflating. So I had a lot of that to negotiate. And then the question is, who's inside and who's outside? Most of the people that I thought were deeply inside, and I was way on the outside, I got my full professorship before they did. So the whole question of who's in, who's out, is a very fluid and subjective thing. And that I learned. In one way, I'm still deeply outside because Hebrew is not my métier. It's not my language. So I'm schizophrenic. I teach in Hebrew. I research in German. And I write in English. And that's the way it's been. So that's more
and
or less...
And you've survived and flourished in a challenging situation. But who was in the department when you arrived? There was Talmon still there?
No, Talmon was gone, but Arieli was there. And who was a fantastically decent man. And a man George very much admired. He dedicated... God, what is the book called? It's a book of essays. Not Nationalism...
Masses and Men?
No. Something of
Nationalism, the one that he did with, it doesn't matter, I guess.
Yeah, I forgot. Why have I forgotten?
But I remember that he did, yeah.
And so Arieli was the person for me. And over the years, he really encouraged me, and he was extremely positive. Then there was Michael Head, who just passed away.
Yes.
Who was very nice to me. And I was friendly at that stage with Gubby Motzkin. We came in together. And then there were some absolutely autistic people, half crazed. I won't mention names, totally unencouraging. Some people who one day you would be talking to and have a lovely conversation, the next day they wouldn't look at you. So that's
typical.
But that's the academic.
It really is.
The autistic kind. But gradually I integrated to the degree that, as you know, I made very close friends with people not in my department,
right.
With the late Jonathan Frankel, who was a wonderful man, and as you heard from my fest, with Ezra Mendelsohn, with whom I became extremely close.